Pseudopod, episode 188, April 2nd, 2010. This week's story, The Dark Level. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast that puts the fun back into fundamentally opposed to all laws of nature. This week's story comes to us from John F.D. Taff, who has been writing for 20 years now, with more than 45 stories in magazines like Death Realm, 2AM and Cemetery Dance, and 7 novels in print. He's also been featured in anthologies like the Hot Blood and Shock Rock series. This story first saw print in Death Realm 25 in 1995 and received an honourable mention in that year's Best Fantasy and Horror, edited by Datlow and Windling. Your narrator this week is Ian Stewart, a professional voice artist and spinner of dark tales who can be found at bedalgo.com, so make sure you have your keys, your briefcase, and most importantly, your wits about you. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Dark Level by John F.D. Taff. With one hand, Jim pulled the yellow flyer from beneath the windshield wiper of his car. What now? Over the last few months, the parking garage had raised its rates and had restricted the number of available spaces to accommodate the employees of the insurance company across the street. Parking was at a premium these days. With the construction boom in full swing and tourism at an all-time high, developers just couldn't seem to put up garages fast enough. Since Jim didn't work for the insurance company, his space kept moving deeper into the bowels of the structure as the owners carved additional spaces for their largest tenant. Draping his coat over his arm, he scanned the flyer. Attention. Effective June the 1st. The Market Street Garage will become the corporate parking structure for First Mutual Indemnity Insurance Company. Only employees and guests will be allowed access to the garage. Any outstanding balance should be paid in full by that date. We have appreciated your business. Oh, shit! He exclaimed, loud enough for the word to echo off the low ceiling in the subterranean chamber. That's Monday, for Christ's sakes! Thanks for the notice! He crumpled the flyer into a little ball and tossed it. His eye fell on several other bald or torn-up flyers. Evidently others had received the news with as much grace. Jim climbed into the car, slinging his briefcase and jacket onto the passenger seat. He ran down a list of the garages he knew, but quickly discarded them all. They were obvious choices, and he was sure the other evicted parkers would be exploring them too. He glanced at his watch. 6:15 p.m. The traffic wouldn't be too bad at this hour. Backing from his space for the last time, he decided to drive around the city for a while, looking for another garage with vacancies. The city blocks transition from offices and restaurants to storefronts and apartments, to dilapidated tenements and vacant, weed-choked lots. Upon reaching one particularly distressed warehouse, Jim decided he was out of luck. Litter blew down the streets, and grey weeds thrust through the pavement. Across an empty lot, he saw 3 lean dogs with dull, matted hair and feral eyes that followed his car. Turning onto a side street, he began a U-turn when he saw a large sign in the corner of his eye, bright and clean and incongruous with the rest of the scenery. Parking, $7 daily. Vacancies? No, he laughed, looking through his rear-view mirror. I can't be this lucky. It was set out a little from a squat one-story building, long and narrow, that fronted the street. The building seemed new compared with its tumble-down neighbours, and Jim could see car bumpers gleaming within like metal teeth in a dark, smiling mouth. He smiled back at it, pleased with his good fortune. The sign was attached to a large metal cabinet with hundreds of tiny numbered compartments. A smaller sign at eye level instructed him to either see an attendant or leave a business card in one of the open boxes, along with a cheque for the monthly charge. Jim searched for an attendant but couldn't find one. With only a little hesitation, he wrote a cheque, folded it round his business card and tucked the parcel into the box marked 1103, closed and locked the tiny door. Feeling happy with himself, he climbed back into his car and pulled away in a swirl of dust and garbage. He didn't hear the scream, low but rising in pitch, or the blare of a car horn coming from the open mouth of the garage. Monday morning came, and Jim wondered at the fact that no other cars followed or preceded him into the garage. And yet, as his car swirled down the ramps, he noticed that almost every parking space was filled. He'd gone slowly down three levels, looking for space 1103, before it became so dark he was forced to turn on the headlights. He barely made out a 3-2-1 in dirty yellow numbers on an empty space to his left, between a Thunderbird and a Stanza. As he wound deeper into the building, his eyes became adjusted to the dim light. Still, he didn't see a single person. No one pulling into a space, climbing out of a car, filing toward the bank of elevators. Motes of dust sparkled in his headlights as his car swept through the aisles. The parked cars wore the dust like sequined dresses. His car curled around the last corner, and he barely saw the numerals painted onto the dingy wall as his headlights raked across them. Level 11. Jim cruised slowly down the aisle until he found 1103. He sighed in relief when it appeared, as much at its existence as at the fact that it was, indeed, unoccupied. When he doused the headlights, though, darkness, complete and utterly impenetrable, surrounded him instantly. He sat there for a minute, debating starting the car and leaving. But to where? This was, quite simply, the only place he knew of right now where he could park. The car door opened, throwing a wedge of pale light. But this weakened quickly, and he was able to see only bumpers, the glare of other windshields. Grabbing his briefcase, he looked back in the direction where he'd seen the elevators on the other floors. He thought he could just make out their vertical shapes. He let the door slip closed, cautiously, unwilling to relinquish the light, as feeble as it was. Jim immediately moved off towards the elevators, his briefcase held before him. The air was cool and slightly damp, heavy with the odours of gasoline and metal, gritty with cement dust. It was very quiet, with none of the sounds associated with a parking garage. The hollow woomph of a car door slamming, tyres squealing around the corners, the sudden ululation of a car alarm. All that he heard was the quiet ticking of a single car engine, cooling in the encompassing murk. And he was sure that it was his. After 5 minutes of stumbling around in the dark and bumping his shin sharply against the fender of a motorcycle, he reached the far wall. His hand splayed out along the wall, dipped into a slight circular depression. Smiling fiercely, he pressed it once, hard. The elevator gave no indication, though, that it had heard his summons. He stabbed the button several times in quick succession. Nothing. Now he'd have to walk the 11 stories up to the mouth of the garage. He found his way back to the ramp more quickly than he'd thought. A handrail guided his movements and made it a bit easier to walk in the dark. By the time he'd gone up four levels, he'd broken a sweat and was fuming mad. "If there is anyone up there when I get there, they're going to get an earful." Another three levels, and he could feel streamers of sweat run down his back, soak into his shirt. And it was still dark, as dark as it had been on the levels below. Jim paused on what he assumed to be the fourth floor, hesitated. Driving in, the lights on this floor had been on. He could barely see the useless fixtures hanging from the pipes and conduits. No light was visible either, as he looked up the ramp another level. By now there should have been some light leaking in from outside. For a moment he thought of returning to the car, if he could even find it now. But he was so close to the entrance that going back seemed ludicrous. Two more levels up, and confusion. Where the fuck am I? This should be the first floor. The far wall was just visible past a row of cars, a ghost-like number painted on it. Cursing, he moved towards it, passing through the channel between two cars. He set his briefcase down, brought his face close to the wall's surface. A big red one was painted there, its outline hard to see against the dirt and grime. And next to it, he saw, was another one. For a moment it refused to register in his mind. A sound, sudden and distant, scraping, soft and barely audible, like something moving across a cement floor, crunching tiny rocks and other debris, coming towards him. "Hello?" he said, hearing his voice rebound flatly off the concrete. The sound ceased immediately. Jim decided it was time to find his car and get the hell out of the garage. The sound began again, a little louder, and his pace quickened with his pulse. Down the row, quickly, his briefcase swinging at his side, the only sounds that of his own footfalls and the gentle sliding crunch behind him. A shape stood out from all the others in the darkness, the familiar outlines of his car, and he ran the last few steps. The key came quickly out of his pocket, poked at the door handle several times before seating itself and slipping in. He turned it, but it wouldn't budge. Nervously, he jammed it in tighter, twisted it again, jimmied it back and forth. Then he noticed the car itself. There wasn't enough light to make out its exact colour, but Jim could narrow it down to black, or brown, or blue, or green. His car was white. The sound neared, stopped before him. Jim stood still, his hand on the key yet in the lock. Suddenly the horn of the car he'd been trying to get into went off, and he jumped back from it as if electrocuted, reeled into the car beside it. His briefcase was flung into the darkness, clunking onto something metal and clattering to the floor. Then every horn in every car in the garage was blasting simultaneously, reverberating off the walls, the low ceiling. Jim covered his ears against the sound, ran back to the ramp. Still, the horns bellowed a continuous, unwavering harmony that resonated in his brain, made his teeth chatter. He ran until he struck a cement pillar head-on, sprawled to the ground. Lights erupted in the darkness, pressed down upon him, and he lost consciousness. From blackness onto blackness, he opened his eyes. He felt the cool air wash over him, the floor press up against him. For a brief moment, disoriented and sore, he couldn't remember where he was. It came back to him on the smells of gasoline and rubber, and he lay there for a while, took stock of his situation as best he could in the dark. There was a knot, tumid and warm, throbbing on his forehead above his left eye. His suit was torn at the elbows, and the heels of his palms were scraped and bleeding. As he drew himself up, he had the disturbing sensation of sinking into something gummy. At first he thought he'd fallen into a patch of tar or asphalt, but he followed the contours of the warm, tacky substance with his fingertips. It felt vaguely organic, and conformed perfectly to the shape of his prone body. It was as if the floor itself had melted beneath him. Springing to his feet, he brushed at the front of his jacket, which felt unusually warm in the cool, moist air. The jacket fell apart under his hands, buttons clinking at his feet. He'd rubbed through its material, which powdered at his touch, to his business shirt. Where the dust from the desiccated suit touched his raw palms, there was a tingling, then a burning sensation. Wincing, he rubbed his hands briskly on his pants, peeling a strip of cloth from the front of each leg. Now he felt the burning on his legs, too, becoming so fierce that his eyes teared. He heard a sound, paused. It was just a tinkle at first, high-pitched, varying in intensity. As he listened motionless, it became a gurgle, a rush. Water! Either the light had increased since he'd lost consciousness, or his eyes had finally adjusted. Whichever, he could see ahead of him a broken pipe angling from the ceiling, water spewing from its severed end. Its sound filled the confines of the garage, echoing within like a secret grotto, and he went to it. The cold water splashed upon him, seared into him. His muscles tightened, his teeth gritted as he brought his hands into its flow, letting it scour his abrasions. Thirsty, too. He drank some of it. So cold he didn't mind its flat metallic aroma or the acrid, bitter taste. Soaked, he turned away from the stream, sloshed to a nearby car and squatted on the fender. He shrugged out of the remainder of his coat, tore his tie off, dropped them both to the ground. A profound fatigue penetrated him, and he didn't even attempt to stifle the head-splitting yawn it produced. Gotta lay down. For a moment. So tired. Jim was barely able to stagger around to the door of the car he'd been sitting on. The door whooshed open without a key, and two things forced their way through Jim's haze at the same time. First was the smell. Sweet. Sticky. Sticky sweet. Overpowering, it flowed out of the car's interior in waves, each one stronger than the last. As he pondered this, his left foot rose over the lip of the floorboard, descended. It kept descending until it was lower than his right, still on the pavement, and he began to fall after his left leg into the car. Inside, he had a glimpse of a dark, deep chasm, whose sides pulsated, glistened wetly in the nether light. At the bottom of this chasm was a shallow pool of thin, brackish liquid, from which poked bones, a skull, several femurs, a hip, a hand waving jauntily. Wrenching himself around, he scrabbled at the doorframe, threw himself backwards. He rolled down the side of the adjoining car, spilled to the floor. The door snapped shut. Although his heart thundered blood through his body, Jim felt the lethargy within him grow stronger. The part of him that mattered simply wanted to slide to the floor and sleep. But he remembered how the floor had dissolved underneath him. Hauling himself unsteadily to his feet, he stumbled away, found another car, locked. Two, three more, all locked. He remembered his suit turning to powder, the bones at the bottom of the pit. I can't fall asleep out here. Another car, and the handle worked. Fumbling the door open, Jim had the presence of mind to reach inside first, feel along until his hand contacted the cold, leathery vinyl seat. He bent, meaning to slide in, but his eyes closed as the wave of exhaustion finally rolled over him, and it became a collapse. Half in and half out of the car, Jim was asleep before his head rebounded from the vinyl. The dark was a familiar thing when he next opened his eyes. His right cheek was stuck to the vinyl, and he pulled it away with a sound like peeling tape. Then noticed he was now entirely inside the car, with the door shut. He scratched his head, swallowed, felt the urgent desire to pee. Then the seat moved, depressed in the middle as if collapsing. Quickly, Jim scooted to the left side of the car, his back pressed against the door, fumbled with the handle. The door wouldn't open, even though it wasn't locked. There was movement again in the car, and this time Jim saw the entire back seat, floorboard and all, descend slowly about 2 feet, then drop from sight. There was a splash from somewhere below. The front seat sank a little more, and Jim grabbed tight to the steering wheel. Jim thought back on the science films he'd seen in grade school. He remembered one particular film that showed a fly sliding down the inside of a pitcher plant, flailing for purchase until it drowned, then, being time-lapse, dissolved by liquid at the bottom of the bowl. He turned, pulled up the handle, beat at the window, screamed. The door didn't move. Something tight and metallic snapped beneath him. The middle of the bench seat sagged. There was a thick, ripping sound, and it fell away. His section now inclined precipitously into the growing maw of the dark pit, and he scrambled to keep his balance, locking his arms round the steering wheel and praying it would hold his weight if necessary. Acting on an impulse, he lunged for the glove compartment, opened it, grabbed whatever was inside, gas receipts, papers, maps, tissues. He tucked these between his legs, fumbled across the dashboard, pushed in. It popped out a few seconds later, and he drew it forth. A baleful red eye. Acting quickly, he pulled the wad of paper out, pushed the cigarette lighter into its centre. After a second or two, it flared into flames. He waited until he was sure the fire had taken. Then he dropped it into the pit. It fell like a meteor, sloughing embers as it tumbled. In the wavering light cast by the projectile, he could see that it had landed on the vinyl seat, which began to burn. Suddenly the whole car shook, and a noise, almost like a moan, rose from the pit. Thick, oily smoke began to roll up from the hole, filling the car's interior quickly, forcing him to wonder whether it had been a good idea after all. Jim chanced a leaning glance below, saw that the back seat was engulfed in flames, which licked at the smooth, wet walls of the pit. Black wheels scarred the walls where the fire touched, and the shrivelled material it revealed underneath looked decidedly green and plant-like. The car shuddered again, followed closely by another groan. Beneath him, the small section of seat he rested on shifted, plummeted. He hung from the steering wheel, coughing in the heat and smoke, his legs pinwheeling above the pit. With his free hand, he tried the door handle again. It moved, grudgingly, and he strained all his weight against it. The door sprang open, collided with the adjacent car, rebounded. Jim caught it, braced it. The flames were tickling his feet now, and he felt the steering column begin to soften, to droop. He swung toward the lip of the floorboard on the driver's side, caught it with both hands, hoisted himself up to ground level. After he did, the door shut forcefully, and there was a loud rumbling that seemed to emanate from all around him. The car's windows lit a lurid orange, shattered. Jim leapt up, scrambled out of the way. The pavement gave way like mud, and the entire car sank crookedly about 3 feet, smoke and flames squishing out from beneath it. On an impulse, he dashed to the nearest car, staying well away from the capsizing, burning wreck he'd crawled from. As he approached the door, he heard a soft but meaty chunk. He tried the handle. Locked. He turned to the next car. Ka-chunk. Up and down the row, and off into the distance, he heard the sound repeated dozens, hundreds of times. You son of a bitch! As if in response, the building shook with another low, throbbing roar. In the fitful light cast by the burning car, he found an old Dodge covered with dust, unlocked. As the door swung open, the car's headlights snapped on, the horn went off, as did all the horns of the cars around him. Although startled, Jim pressed on. Ignoring the wailing horns and flashing lights, he searched the car for any paper or clothing. Anything that would burn. Everything he found, from rags to clothing, from paper to fast food boxes, was piled in the middle of the row when he'd finished. He regarded it with grim pride. Gathered near the pile, like acolytes, were two gas cans. He'd become alarmed when none of the cigarette lighters in the cars he'd gotten into worked. Soon after, though, he'd scrounged up 3 Bic lighters and a pack of matches. One of the gas cans was emptied quickly, dousing every car he could get to before finally running out. The contents of the other can he used to soak the material in the pile. Both empty containers were also thrown onto the pile. The smell of gas, formerly a ghost, was now a physical presence in the building, floating on the air, cloying at Jim's senses. He stood before the pile, flipping the book of matches over and over in his hand. In case this didn't work, he held the lighters in reserve. He pulled one of the matches off, struck it. Light suddenly flooded his senses, and for a moment he thought he'd ignited the gas in the air. He braced himself against a rush of heat, a blast of air. But none came. Instead, daylight sparkled off glass and metal and chrome, spilling gold into dark recesses, blotting out shadows. The entrance beckoned to his right, up just one level of the ramp. He'd been on the second floor all along. Jim felt the sun warm his clammy, half-clothed body, felt its tug. But Jim had never heard of a pitcher plant releasing its prey. "Ah, forget it," he said out loud, flipping the match onto the mound. It erupted even before the match touched, and Jim felt the air around him being sucked toward it. An enormous fireball mushroomed to the ceiling, feelers racing along the floor towards the fuel-covered cars. The garage shook again, a pained, high-pitched squeal as the cars burst into flames. Jim dashed toward the exit, passed through it, blinked and teared at the sudden onslaught of light. The first thing he saw when his vision cleared were the three dogs, standing together in a loose group about 20 feet from him. They ignored him, though, their fearful canine eyes taking in the fire. Thick black smoke poured from the structure, which had already begun to fall in on itself, sagging here and there. It seemed to melt, though, more than collapse, the way Jim supposed a real building would. But then again, it wasn't a real building. Several muffled explosions punctuated the fire as cars exploded within. They, apparently, were real enough. His had been. He stood there for some time, in his dirty business shirt and underwear, black socks and dress shoes, and watched the fire burn. Smoke drifted toward him, and he smelled gasoline and burning rubber. Something else that smelled of sweetly burning green wood and sugar. The smoke rose high into the air, blotting out an entire section of the sky. He surveyed the vacant lot around him, littered with paper, soda cans, over-large beer bottles, kicked an area clear and sat. He noticed a large weed poking out of the dry, hard-scrabble ground. On a whim, he yanked it up, roots and all, pulled a lighter from his breast pocket, and roasted the plant. He didn't notice something burst open on the roof of the now totally involved garage. Didn't see the hundreds of tiny furry spheres it released into the hot, swirling air. Didn't see how they were caught by the wind, carried aloft, east, toward downtown.
I love the dark, empty spaces where people should be, but aren't. It comes, at least in part, from having to be in school an hour before everyone else due to my dad being a teacher, and the sense of peace that big building with basically no one in it but us gave off. I got the same thing a few years later, when I started going to press screenings for films, and frequently was the only person in the theatre designed for several hundred people. It's a really odd feeling, and it lies somewhere between being backstage at a rock concert and being the king of your own private little world. Everything's there, but it's there just for you. Curdle that feeling, though. Turn it just a little to the right, and you have something very different. You have Robert Neville, watching recordings of the news from before the world ended. You have the quietly desperate correspondence at the heart of the Dionea House, or the terrible, terrible things glimpsed at the edge of the frame in the superb Marble Hornets ARG. Well, you get this story, and the sickly plausible idea that tickles the back of all our brains. That nature is exactly the same for us as it is for things lower down the food chain. There is always another predator, and it's not the big ones you have to worry about. It's the clever ones. The ones that look like you, or what you need the most. The ones that realize that we only see certain things and just assume the rest is fine until it rears up and consumes us. The ones that hide in plain sight and kill in plain sight and wait in plain sight to kill again. Hurdle that feeling, and you're not alone in a world built for your amusement. You're alone in a world of predators, and they all know where you are. We don't know where you are, but we do know where your money is, and we know where we'd quite like some of your money to be. We rely on your donations to pay our authors and cover our costs, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise every cent is appreciated. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and it's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod find itself facing a door that it should not be in front of.